Welcome to Coffee with Kelly.
I'm your host, Ethan Woodman, product marketing specialist for Crisis Go, and I'm joined by my colleague, Kelly Moore, school safety analyst for Crisis Go. We will be discussing emergency response and incident command systems. In our first segment, we'll dive into the cyclical nature of emergencies and how each phase influences the next, using the left of bang concept to explain the timeline of an emergency. In the second segment, we will focus on the incident command system and unified command in the context of school safety. We will explain the organizational structure of ICS, the roles and responsibilities of each section, and how the unified command system is used when multiple jurisdictions have legal mandates that are technically responsible for what's happening during an emergency. So stay tuned as we dive into the world of school safety.
Well, good morning, Kelly. I feel like it's been a super long time since the last time that we've chatted. How's life been for you?
Good. Busy, but good. It's been a couple weeks.
Yeah. Anything exciting? Just the usual Kelly stuff.
Yeah. We wrote some what I call bonus blogs, one on swatting. I'm doing another one on including those with disabilities in your emergency plans and what that means to people. So that's coming up shortly.
Steven, I will admit, when you had mentioned swatting to me, I had no idea what swatting was until you started talking about it, and then I understood. Yeah.
It's a huge thing that's happening right now, and it's some people are just saying, oh, it's just false alarms, but it causes so many issues. And again, unfortunately, it's another hazard that we have to account for in our all hazards plans.
Yeah, I'm sure it's when you're of that age, it could probably, you know, just seem as a joke, but it could turn into something much more, for sure.
Yeah, when we're talking about just the trauma, all right, you know, people complain about the trauma and all that's caused by doing drills, pre-planned, notified, and all that. Now, all of a sudden, you have unannounced, you have all this law enforcement presence and so forth that goes along with that kind of call. It's a huge thing. So yeah, we'll talk about it later, next podcast or two.
Okay. Sounds good. So today, Kelly, I think we're going to start talking about emergency response and management cycles. So we're kind of, again, getting a little bit more into detail about some topics that you've talked about before. So this is, again, really cool that we're getting more into details and learning more. So kind of give me a highlight of what are we talking about today?
Well, regardless of the emergency, there's this natural cycle that all of these emergencies and processes, stages that you will experience. And if you understand the cycle, then you can predict what you need to do next. And it helps with even those who are moderately involved or knowledgeable about the process. It helps them pre-plan the next step so that you can really work through these problems much quicker. And we have to look at the acknowledgement of the triggering event is not necessarily the start of the event. And we'll get into real briefly the concept of left of bang and right of bang. And we'll discuss that a little bit.
In your blog, you give a definition of what an emergency is. So you write that an emergency is any event or situation that is likely to cause or has caused significant disruption, injury, and or death to one or more people. So one of my first questions for you is, what designates as like disruption? Can you give me some examples of what that may look like?
Sure. Let's use this scenario for a disruption. You're at your commencement ceremony for graduation from high school, and some senior decides he's going to light off a series of firecrackers.
Very likely scenario.
Right? What does that actually cause? What's the purpose of that? Disruption, right? Nobody's thinking that that's going to cause any injuries or anything, but it's meant to be a disruption, a joke. But in today's day and age, those firecrackers are going to sound like gunfire. And you're going to have a mass panic.
That's very right? true.
So yeah. In that panic, you're likely going to have some injuries, twisted ankles, potentially heart attacks, because you're going to have old people there who aren't familiar with what's going on, those types of things. So that practical joke meant to disrupt is likely going to cause some injuries or something going on that's going to cause a significant amount of resources to mitigate and to solve. The other type of disruption is if you have your powers out or something like that and you can't continue with school. I'm pausing because my dogs are barking.
You're pausing because your dog is disrupting our podcast?
Yes. Hold on one second. So there's other disruptions that are possible, right? The water, you have a water issue, broken pipe that disrupts the ability to operate under normal conditions. Electricity, like I said. So there's lots of things for disruption.
Okay. And when we're looking at emergencies, there's, as you've laid out here, an order, basically, to those emergencies. And the first step is the initial response, right? So let's talk about that a little bit. What does the initial response typically look like?
So the initial response is whatever triggered that emergency. So the smoke detector that triggers an alarm because it detects that there's a fire, right? So that whatever triggers that event is what causes the first initial response. And what we're trying to do with that is really trying to find out as much as we can very quickly as to what's happening and what we need to do. And so then we can start setting up our objectives for the next few steps. And it's important that we understand what's happening to us. Now, where a lot of people get sort of stuck is they want to know exactly what's happening to us. And they get paralyzed by, people call this paralysis by analysis. They want to have all the information as opposed to enough information to make a decision. And so what we're trying to do is get enough information so that we can make a good decision to protect our staff and students.
I thought this was such a great point because I look back and I have to like look at myself every time we're doing this and say, like, am I falling in the right category here? Am I doing the right things? And this is totally me. Like, I'm one of those people where it's a paralysis by analysis kind of situation. So I thought this was such a good point to make.
Yeah, so that's actually called heuristic. And it's a process by which you create psychological shortcuts to solving complex problems or simplify complex issues. And it's gained by experience, knowledge, working through these previously. And this is the official name for what we've talked about extensively of reducing the reactionary gap. So I go in, I hear the fire alarm as an example. Do I need to find out where the fire is? Do I need to know what's actually burning? Do I need to know what caused the fire? No. The fire alarm is telling me it's detecting something. So what's my decision? I need to figure out first, do we think it's an alarm that was set off manually for the purpose of targeting? Do I actually need to evacuate? Then I can say, where is the alarm coming from? The boiler room. What does that mean to me? Probably should evacuate. Do things that you would normally do in a fire. But I don't need to know who set the fire. I don't need to know how the fire department's going to put it out. I don't need all of this information. I just need to know there's likely a fire, and what do I need to do to protect my students and staff?
Yep, that was a great example.
Thank you.
So then the you're very welcome, Kelly. The the next step that you have here is protection of life and property. You kind of started to hit on that a little bit. So what does that look like in terms of looking at an emergency?
Yeah, so the initial response and the primary objective is in any emergency is the preservation of life and then property in that order. So I want to take the quickest step, the most effective step to protect everybody as best I can. So now we have to start asking our questions about what do I need to do to protect all of my people? How do I notify them? How do I communicate with them? How do I account for them? How do I do all of these things that I need to protect them with the objective of protecting them? And can I do something if I have everyone in a protective action? They're evacuated from the fire, or they are in lockdown or secure or sheltering, whatever the case may be. If they're all in a safe place or as safe as can be expected under the circumstances, can I start accounting for them, finding out who needs what, who's injured, where are they, what are the injuries, those types of things. But the reality is in order to get them into that emergency protective action as quickly as possible, we have to notify them. So how are we doing that? And getting them into that emergency protective action is likely the most important step that you take as soon as you figure out what you have. And because we know there's this gap between when we call 911 and when they show up. Now, we can discuss what that gap is, but average, I think we talked about this a podcast or two ago, is about 8 to 10 minutes. And we've seen this in recent events. That's a long time. So you don't necessarily need to make that 911 call first. You need to get everyone moving into a position where they can protect themselves, or they're protected by the position that they're in. Then you call 911. Obviously, with today's technology, we can do both at the same time, and that's ideal. So you can send an alert and trigger a 911 response at the same time. So that's ideal. But if you have a choice and you have to do one or the other, your first should be getting everyone into this emergency protective action. And then as soon as that action has been initiated, then you can call 911 or have somebody else do it while you're still working on moving people to safety.
That's great. Yeah, because I feel like, you know, there's probably some, definitely some scenarios where you've always been taught, like, you know, just call 911 and that might be your first action, but you're not taking care of the crisis at hand that you can personally kind of, you know, address beforehand. So that's a great
point. Yeah. So if we take the primary emergency that we're all talking about, active shooter, active violence,
Sure.
If you press 911, how long does that take? A couple seconds. But then you get on the line and somebody has to tell you what's going on. You have to tell them what's going on. They're going to ask questions. Where are you at? Who are you? What's happening? Where are they at? All of these processes. And then you take into account the general culture of schools where everything has to run through the administration before you call 911. So now you're talking, explaining everything two or three times, or the person who's actually calling is not the person who has all the information. So that exacerbates the response time, right? And if you have this incident occurring, and when we say seconds matter, then the more seconds you take not putting people into an emergency protective action matters. We're talking life and death, right? Get them into a safety position and then call for help, and you can mitigate, you can take steps to mitigate injuries and deaths as quickly as possible.
So this is where all your previous blogs really come into play, because we've talked about roles and responsibilities and what that means. So it's, you know, if you know all these things, that moment is going to be a lot easier, right?
Right. You're going to reduce that reactionary gap. You're going to say, oh, those were shots. Hit the button. Everyone goes into a lockdown. Call 911. The troops are en route to come take care of that problem. As you are waiting for law enforcement and everyone's in this lockdown position, then you can start asking other questions. How many are injured? Where are they? Do we have all of our students accounted for? If not, why? Where are they? You can start asking all of those questions. What are you seeing? You can put that out to the staff. What are you seeing? What are you hearing? What are you smelling? What do you need from me to keep you safe until law enforcement comes and handles that problem? All of those questions. What am I going to have to do next? Right? It's not for really productive for us to just press the button and just wait. We need to start thinking about, and that's your job as a leader on your campus, whoever's has that responsibility. That's your job to start putting everything into motion without getting tied up into the details of exactly what is happening. Does that make sense? Because now we're going to, at some point, law enforcement's going to have to, they're going to show up. They're going to want to know what you know. Fire department's going to want to know, right?
Which leads us to the next step here called incident stabilization.
Right. Yeah. So law enforcement's going to come. You're going to tell them, this is what we know. This is where we last heard from or saw them. You can pull it up on our video. You can do whatever, or we can direct you to where you need to go. They're going to go isolate the threat, whatever that means, given the circumstances. Once they can do that, then now we can start bringing in the fire department, the emergency medical people, and treating injuries, triaging the injuries, starting to accurately account for everybody so we know exactly who's where and what's happened to them. And we can start moving into the phase where we start evacuating people from the building. We can start working on the reunification process. We can start really managing this event and the aftermath of this event and what that's going to look like. That initial response is that first response phase, as we talk about in the FEMA guidelines. But now we're going to have to start managing this event. We're going to really have to start worrying about all the details. Parent notification, instructions to the parents. What do you want them to do? Who, if you have injuries, where are they going to? Who's going to notify the parents of those or family members of those that were injured? That's the stabilization. It's no longer a threat, but now we have lots of work to still do.
How important do you think parent notification is during these processes?
Is that a rhetorical question?
A little bit.
Right. I will tell you, this is one of our biggest issues in school emergencies.
Really?
Because of the status and the knowledge that people have around incidences at school. In the school district that I worked for, if there was an emergency vehicle on campus, they had to notify the district office cabinet. Somebody at the district office had to know that there was a fire truck on your campus. Even if it was just they're driving through or they had to do an inspection.
Interesting. Okay.
Because the district would get calls. Why are the fire trucks on the, what are they doing?
Huh. Like from parents nearby or whatever?
Yep.
Wow.
Or I was leaving campus and I saw a fire truck coming in with its lights on. Well, little Johnny broke his ankle at football practice. So we had to address that medical emergency. But people tend to go to worst case scenario.
Yeah.
And so we just have to notify the parents. We need to make sure that they understand exactly what is going on and what we want them to do. And we don't do that well enough.
I could see how not notifying parents could result in some level of disruption.
Yeah. So let me give you a Kelly story.
Here we go.
One of my first jobs when I retired from the sheriff's department and went to work for the school district was to meet with a parent group who were upset about how a principal at a high school handled what was thought to be a gang issue. If you sat down and looked at what the principal did, you'd probably say, that was reasonable. But he refused to communicate to the parents. Hey, we're having this issue and we're on it. We have the sheriff's department coming in, helping us with this. We have all the resources we need, but we just wanted to let you know that we're having these issues. And can you please talk to your kids about this? And this is what we want you to say. Nope. He held to that position. This is my job. I handle it. I don't need to parents' involvement. He was fired.
I'm sure the parents were just ecstatic.
Right. He was fired. And he lost the confidence of this parent group. And this parent group went from the high school, this one high school, to all of the high schools and all of the middle schools having the same issue.
Wow.
Right. So I had to work with the parent group and it was easy. I'm saying, hey, this is what we're going to do. And this is how we're going to do it. And we're going to do it at all of the schools the same way. And that was, we were able to squash that pretty quickly.
Nice.
At first, you know, you go through these relationship issues where they have to, they don't trust you because they don't know who you are.
Right.
So you have to build that trust and you have to explain to them, this is what we're going to do. Then they have to see the results of that. And then all of a sudden, what started out to be a weekly meeting turned into a monthly meeting, turned into, we don't need to meet. We're good to go. But that all could have been handled with communications from the onset.
So this, you said it was a principal. So just the fact that, you know, he may have done all the right things in the moment, but just the fact that he didn't communicate it out to the parents cost him his job.
Yeah. And didn't communicate initially at all. And then when he did, it was insufficient because he's now he's trying to play catch up and he fell short of that. So
I would say communication's very important.
Yes.
And parents have some level of power over what goes on. So
parents drive everything that goes on, regardless of what the schools think.
Yep.
They drive what happens in your schools.
So I think we can transition a little bit, and we're going to be discussing the differences between an incident command system, or ICS, and a unified command. So this is definitely pretty new to me. So tell me all about this, Kelly.
We don't have enough time for me to tell you all about it.
Well, okay. See you next week. No.
So incident command is the big white elephant in the room. We try to teach it as this savior to this solution to all our problems is incident command. And then when we try to teach it, it is so complicated or perceived to be so complicated that people just get overwhelmed that they don't know what to do with it. So let me take one step back there. Incident command is generally taught by the fire departments of the nation. The fire departments live and die by incident command. They literally, and this isn't an exaggeration, wash their fire trucks using the incident command system. So you have somebody who's responsible for making sure the fire trucks are clean and working properly, right? So that's the incident commander. Then that incident commander sees that the fire truck needs some attention. So that guy appoints somebody to wash the truck. That's operations. The guy who's responsible for washing the truck needs to look at what needs attention on the truck. So he starts planning. Okay, this is the truck. This is what I need to do. I'm going to do my little inspection. I'm going to do this. And that's planning. I'm going to plan how to wash this truck effectively, efficiently. But in order for me to do that, I need buckets, sponges, soap, chamois, whatever else.
Sham-wow. So
the ShamWow, right?
Yeah.
And I need to get those from the supply logistics. And because I'm using materials, supplies, because I am using my time to wash this truck, because I was ordered to wash the truck, I need somebody who's accounting for all of the administrative functions that go along with it. How long is it taking me? How much are the supplies costing? What happens if I get injured? So then that's your fourth function, administrative, finance, HR stuff. That's incident command. So the definition from me is, and I had to create my own definition because the fire guys live and die by this. They know all the numbers to all the forms. They teach it in the academy. They understand it. But law enforcement, they have an idea, but they don't use it every day. I mean, they use it every day. They just don't identify it as such. And so you have to teach ICS differently to different people. Don't teach law enforcement like you teach the fire guys. Don't teach the school districts ICS like you teach the fire guys, because they use it once or twice in their entire career. They could use it every day, but that would cause people to restructure their organizations, rename their organizations, which might not be a bad thing. But the reality is ICS is a structure, a management structure, where you have one person in charge, and you also have identified objectives and functions, tasks that need to be completed, and somebody is assigned to accomplish those tasks and is responsible for the completion of those tasks, functions, and such. That's it. Understanding that I know exactly who I work for and who works for me and what tasks am I responsible or is my team responsible for. That's it. Fundamentally, that's what incident command is.
And you've kind of, yeah, you've definitely talked about this before, but maybe not labeled it as incident command, but you've definitely discussed this before.
Yeah, of course.
So it's good that we're hitting on this again.
Yeah. People just get scared by those three initials, incident command system, ICS, because it's taught like you have to be very strict to this. You really don't. And I have lots of experience in the incident command where parts of the incident in these very large natural disasters that I've been involved with, where everything was done by the book. And I've been involved in some very large incidents where we use the incident command, but not a strict adherence to it. So, and we get the same result. So I think we need to teach it differently. I had to teach ICS, and I'll give you a Kelly story. I think I might have gave this before, but we had a very large fire, and I was a sergeant at the time, a patrol sergeant, and we had evacuated a large large area of a community. If we evacuate that, we have to secure it so that there's no looting and stuff going on. So we have these patrols going around the neighborhoods. And I go up this mountain road in this community, and I see a fire getting close to a house. And I continue up the road a little bit, and there's five fire trucks. In the business, they call that a strike force or a strike team.
Yep.
And I say, hey, guys, just so you know, there's a fire down the road. And they say, yeah, we understand there's a fire. I says, yeah, but it's close to a house. Oh, okay, we'll report it. And I said, okay. I thought they would just get in their trucks and go down there and put out the fire. And then it dawned on me when they said this. They said, hey, can you do me a favor and tell your guys to stop reporting fires? We know there's a fire out there. We're here because there's a fire out there. We'll let them know, and then they'll let us know if they want us to put it out. And I just go, oh, okay, great. So it dawned on me at that point that if they called in and they reported the fire that I had seen and their command didn't redirect them there, and their command didn't talk to them for 3 days, if you went back to that spot in 3 days, they'd be sitting there waiting for something to do, because the incident command controls everything that's happening. If I take that same scenario and I told a patrol deputy, hey, there's some looting happening at 1234 Main Street. Go check it out. That deputy would go up there and he would say, oh, there's nothing up here. And if I didn't talk to that deputy for 3 days, that deputy would be three counties away, because that deputy's just going to turn around and start solving the problems, because that's what they do every day. They look for problems and they try to solve them, try to prevent things from happening. So the reason I say that is because when I teach incident command to a deputy, if I want the same result in knowing where that deputy is, I have to say, solve every problem between 001 Main Street and 2000 Main Street, and I'll know about where he's at, because I have to teach it like it's a beat system for them. So we have to talk differently to the people, and it has to be done differently for the schools as well.
So with an incident command system, you know, you've got some various titles here. Are they different in school, or could a school basically kind of give these titles to certain people?
They should give these titles to people, because you're asking for help from people who are going to use these titles. Now, it's not your everyday title.
Right.
Right. You're not going to call the principal, the incident commander, unless there's an emergency.
Right.
Right. Okay. So, you could, but that's really not what they're trying to do. Right. They're just trying to find out who's in charge of the management of this incident. So give them a title. I'm the incident commander. I'm the operations section chief. I'm the planning's intel chief. I'm the logistics chief, or I'm the admin chief, section chief, right? That way people are talking the same language. But once you get from that perspective, you have the operations, planning, intel, logistics, and admin in the incident commander. Those are really the only titles you actually need, because the people underneath each of those will know who that is. The people above them will know who that is. And everything will run through those people.
So I like how this, maybe you did this on purpose. I like how this plays into what we were discussing before of, making a decision and not necessarily having to have all the information in front of you to make that decision. And as you illustrated in your Kelly story, you could be facing a situation and you don't need to go through all of these various titles and people and get, confirmation from them. If you're there and you know what to do, you just make the decision.
Yeah. You know what your objectives are, right? You know what the higher goal is. So your overall objectives and the objectives for our scenario, active shooter, is, and it's very, very simple. There's three objectives, right? Is stop the killing, stop the dying, start the recovery, right? So those are the three objectives from a very high level. So now that everyone that's in there is working to one of those three objectives, they don't need permission because they know what the objective is.
Right. Those are pretty simple to understand. So
yeah, as long as you're stopping the person from killing or injuring other people, and those that are injured are treated, and then you start the recovery. If you're working to one of those three objectives, you're good to go. If you need help, ask. That's what the incident command, chain of command is for, is to support those three objectives.
As you mentioned chain of command, it reminds me of the, you wrote here, and you say, if a function is not assigned to a person or team, the responsibility to complete that function falls squarely upon the shoulders of the person who was responsible for assigning that responsibility. So very important that whoever is, assigning responsibilities, that you actually assign, responsibilities, because if you don't, everything falls on you.
Right. Yep.
And wearing a whole lot of hats in a very stressful situation is probably not going to yield a very positive result.
No, but it shows the absolute responsibility. So if you have an incident commander or somebody who's taken that function on, and something is not happening, it's their responsibility to make sure that it happens. If you need more resources, if somebody needs to tell you where to go, that operations, if something in that is not being taken care of in those three objectives, it's your responsibility to make sure it is. So operationally, if you don't activate the operational function of an incident as the incident commander, it's yours. You're the one that should be stopping the killing, stopping the dying, and stopping or starting the recovery. That's your responsibility.
It's a lot to put on one person's shoulders.
So delegate it. Expand the system so that it works best for you. And that's the nice thing about the incident command system. It can be run by one person. If your incident is small, oftentimes it is, then you can act as all of that, theoretically washing the fire truck. If you go by the fire truck and say, hey, this needs to get washed, and there's no one else there to do it, you're the incident commander. You're the guy that's actually going to do it. So your operations, you're going to plan how you're going to do it. You're going to go get the supplies out of the supply closet, and then you're going to tell admin, hey, I used up all the supplies. We need to get some more. It costs this much money.
So what is the difference between what we just discussed and a unified command?
So this is relatively new to this whole ICS. And when I say relatively, it's been around for a long time, but people are using it more and more. And unified command is exactly like the incident command system. All of the names are the same, all of that stuff. The difference comes in is the command itself. So in incident command, we talked about having one person making those decisions, who's responsible for the successful outcome of that incident. Unified command is the exact same, except for this. Oftentimes, our legal responsibilities and jurisdictions overlap, and different agencies have essentially equal responsibility, both legally and morally, for that incident. So how do you pick who's going to run it? The answer to that is you're not. They're all going to run it together. You're not going to say, police department, this is yours. Because there's a lot of things that are fire department centric. In a school situation, there's an awful lot of things with the schools that they're legally responsible for. So you can't take that legal responsibility and just put it on somebody else. You have to work together, and you have to talk and make these decisions together. And that's the whole idea behind the unified command. Now, to illustrate that, unified command, law enforcement has the responsibility for the crime being committed and the stoppage of that crime. The fire department has the responsibility for the rescue and triage of those who were injured during the incident. The school has the legal responsibility for their staff and their students. So we've talked about the I love you guys. They say, to summarize that, law enforcement owns the crime, fire owns the patients, schools own the students and staff. So when we're making decisions, we tend to make decisions based upon what we're familiar with and what our responsibilities generally are. So if we're going to make the best decision for this incident, we need the input and how our decisions are impacting the other entities. We need their input on making this decision.
So I could imagine that not working with your local law enforcement and fire department and hospitals and et cetera could make this a pretty difficult process.
Very difficult. And you get some infighting if somebody says, I'm in charge. You know, if you're the first one there, you have to designate yourself as such, because it goes back to what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
If I don't have somebody to do it, it's me.
Right.
So I go, hi, it's Kelly. I'm here. I'm in charge. And then the fire guy comes in and says, hi, I'm Dave. I'm in charge. And the school system comes in and says, hi, I'm Ethan. I'm in charge. And they're all working independently. That doesn't work either, because my cops are doing something that's very dangerous. My fire guys are doing something that might interfere with my dangerous operation. My school might say, it's time to evacuate. but I'm not done isolating the threat. So you can see where those conflicts could be very consequential.
Yeah.
And so get everyone at the table. Now, this goes back to what we've talked about ad nauseum about partnerships and why it's important that you have a positive relationship with your emergency services partners, your fire departments, your police departments, your, if your state police are going to be coming in, they need to be involved with this process. Hospitals, emergency medical services, ambulances, paramedics, those types of people. So you need to have these conversations and you need to have them often so that when you have an actual emergency or an actual event, it's not the first time you guys are meeting, because that takes time to figure out and trust people. And if I don't trust you, I'm going to start working at my speed with my people, and I'm going to create this silo. So we need to work with the people. We need to get involved. And I have to say that we instituted that at the school I was at. I was that point of contact with the emergency services for any incident that occurred at the schools. But I already had the relationship with law enforcement because I'd been in it for 34 years. The fire departments, because I'd worked with them several times, in excess of 30 times in large-scale incidences. And so they knew who I was. So me going into the command center and saying, hey, this is our piece from the school, and we would work through that. And that worked very well. But not all the schools are going to have that dynamic already set. That's why you need to force that dynamic and get people sitting at the table and working through these long before they actually happen.
So to kind of bring this to a conclusion here, what are some reasons that it's important to understand and use these incident command systems or unified command models that we've discussed? Yeah,
there's two primaries, plus I'll give you a bonus one. But
ooh, bonus.
Yeah, bonuses are good, right? Free stuff. So it can save lives. Literally, if you have a well-functioning management system and you implement it, it will save lives because you can effectively and efficiently tackle all of the problems that are being thrown at you. If you don't do it correctly, it can cost lives. And we've seen this.
It's very true, fortunately.
We've seen where poor management or the lack of management have cost lives. That's not the legacy you want. We've talked about legacy. You want to be able to say, I managed this properly. I did everything that we could given the circumstances. And some people want you to be perfect, but we all understand that you're not going to be perfect. But if you've done everything you possibly could, then people will forgive you for that. They'll understand that. But if you completely mess it up and you were incompetent or negligent or never knew what to do, they're not going to forgive that. We'll talk about that for years to come.
So if one of your mantras is student safety is our number one priority, then you should probably understand and use these models.
You should understand what that actually means. And that's using these models in an incident. That means preparing to use these models in an incident long before. You know, we talked about left a bang just briefly. Let me bring that up real quick. So the concept of left a bang is that triggering point for the emergency, whatever that is. Everything left of that, if you put the emergency on a timeline and you're looking at it, everything left of the triggering thing is something that should have, could have happened before that triggering event. Plans, preparations, if we're talking about FEMA, right? The prevention phase, the preparation phase, and everything that happens after that is too late. essentially. Now you're in response and recovery of the theme of things. So if we look at how we can affect the outcomes, prevent, in many cases, prevent this from ever occurring, but how we can affect the outcomes by what we do before bang, then we are so much better off. Now, when we look at understanding this, and you know, the second primary reason of why you should do this, because if you don't do it correctly, you're going to get sued. If you do it correctly, even if you get sued, you'll have all your ducks in a row. You'll be able to say, I did everything left of bang that I could possibly do. And then when we couldn't prevent this from happening, we did everything that we could possibly do to mitigate the circumstances, the situation. We're in a litigious society. You're going to get sued.
Yeah.
And if you're not doing what is expected of you, we talked about this as well, 24 years since Columbine, what is the expectation of your community and your parents? Probably much higher than what you are thinking you have already done. So let's get on it.
And what's the bonus reason?
If you're using it correctly, it sets you up for that. It documents everything. Everything's recorded. So you can work through your process improvements. You can work through documenting to help with your defense. Should you be sued? Training, all of these things come out of the documentation, your after action reports, all of that stuff. It documents that. I tell you, I don't know how many times we've relied in my past life, how many times I've relied on documentation to defend our actions because somebody assumed we didn't do it. And if you're using these systems correctly and effectively, that documentation will be there.
And it's probably, I would think it'd be more likely that someone would go to the efforts of, you know, making a lawsuit against a school than a police. I feel like they'd be more likely to go against a school than a police, but maybe that's just me. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it just depends. I mean, it depends on the circumstances, but generally speaking, if you're going to sue somebody as the result of an incident, they're going to look at the people who don't have the documentation. They're going to look at the people who aren't meeting the expectations. They're going to look at those people who outwardly did something or didn't do something that was required. Right. And law enforcement is sued all the time. Government is sued all the time. Schools are not. So they don't necessarily set themselves up to defend themselves.
I can see that. Yeah.
But we're seeing it more and more. $100 million, $27
billion. Yeah. Once you start getting to the billions, it gets a little. I guess that gets pretty scary.
$100 million would bankrupt most yeah. districts. If they had to write a check for that.
Certainly. Yeah.
Right. So this is where the past almost 5 months comes together is during the management. Generally speaking, the initial response, especially by well-trained law enforcement, fire, and medics, they will go in and handle that situation pretty quickly. Your job is to protect everybody you can while they're coming and ensure the proper management of that incident. Because generally speaking, the response will be handled by those emergency response agencies pretty effectively. But it's how we manage the incidences that we will be remembered for. You can either be on the side, well, that was fantastic, they did this. Or you can be on the other side of that, where they're looking at what are they doing? Why didn't they do this? Why did this happen? And that will be remembered. And that's not the side you need to be on. put in the work, prepare, prevent, learn how to respond appropriately, learn how to recover, all of those things that we've been talking about for the last 5 months. If you need any help, call me. Be happy to talk with anybody about this.
We'll put Kelly's phone number and address and all of his other information on the website. Go bother him.
I put my phone number out there. I don't care. I'll talk to anybody. Leave a message.
You really will.
I will. Mm-hmm.
I can attest to this. He will talk to anybody.
Yep. Doesn't cost me anything to talk.
Just your time.
Yeah. And I'm old. So there you go.
Time becomes more and more valuable as there's less of it.
I suppose it does.
That's all we have for today's podcast on emergency response and incident command systems. We hope you've gained valuable insights into the different phases of emergency response and the importance of being prepared for any situation. We also explored the incident command system and unified command and how they can be used to ensure mandates and concerns are addressed during emergencies. Remember, understanding emergency response and incident command systems can make a significant difference in saving lives and property. If you enjoyed today's episode, please like, subscribe, and hit that notification bell. And if you have any questions about what we've discussed, please leave a comment on our website at crisisgo.com. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Coffee with Kelly, a discussion on school safety.